will begin the meeting of the House Committee on Judiciary. We're going to start. Initially, let me make an announcement. On Friday, the trip to the Oregon Youth Authority will meet at 12:30. They'll have a van for us out in front of the Capitol, and we'll be going to Woodburn. It's about 30 minutes. They'll have us back to the Capitol by 4 p.m. I think the plan will be that if you live north, you'll want to probably take your car. If not, they'll have you back to the Capitol by 4. So 12:30 to 4 on Friday afternoon for the trip to McLaren. And I encourage you, if you've never been there before, it's well worth your time. With that, let's go ahead and start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2049. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2049, I'm having the staff measure summaries printed, and they will be brought out in a minute. But briefly, House Bill 2049 requires that a motion to amend a pleading to assert a claim for punitive damages be served in not less than 45 days before trial. As some of you practitioners know, currently there is no limit as to when a motion to amend a pleading to add a claim for punitive damages can be brought. Indeed, sometimes they are brought in the middle of trial. This bill would require that such pleadings be amended 45 days before trial, which is the same time frame currently applicable to motions for summary judgment. However, you may recall in our last meeting where the Council on Court Procedures came and presented, they are proposing a change that the motion for summary judgment time frame be moved to 60 days before trial. It's my understanding that if assuming that goes forward, that there will be an amendment for this measure making this date also applicable at 60 days before trial instead of 45, so that attorneys wouldn't have to deal with two separate dates for amending their pleading to add punitive damages and for bringing a motion for summary judgment.
Colleagues, before you is also a letter from John, I believe it's pronounced Kemp, who is an attorney at Golovin Hauser. We don't have anybody who signed up, but I think it was Mr. Kemp who originally contacted the Judiciary Office during the interim and raised this issue. And so it his request, we had the bill drafted. Is there anyone else here who's planning on testifying on House Bill 2049? Okay. Do you want to share that, Council?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've spoken with the representative for the trial lawyers who does not necessarily have a problem with the bill in theory. They do have a couple concerns regarding cases that would be subject to mandatory arbitration, for instance, in the Multnomah County Mandatory Arbitration Program for practitioners. Again, once you go through mandatory arbitration, apparently, although I'm not aware of a statutory limitation, there is a Court of Appeals case that says you cannot thereafter amend your pleading after arbitration. Obviously, that would help the parties to arbitrate what is at issue and not be worried that there are certain things that aren't going to be or that might be at issue afterwards. It's my understanding that an amendment could be drafted to deal with that issue. Personally, in my own practice, I've had attorneys amend after arbitration to add such things as claims for attorney's fees. And I have never personally brought up that there is some kind of prohibition against so amending after arbitration, but that was one concern raised by the trial attorneys. But otherwise, they, in theory, as I understood it, were generally in support of the bill, had no problems with it.
Any thoughts or discussion? Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, since we don't have someone here speaking either on behalf or in opposition, do we want to have any amendments as counsel has recommended, just to have them being drafted and then maybe review this one more time?
Yeah, I think that's probably the plan. As I mentioned, you have the letter from Mr. Kemp that sort of lays out his thought process on the original change from to a 45-day limit. I think all of us have been on, at one point or another, who practice, have been on the receiving end of a late amendment like this. I do think it's disruptive both to the court and obviously to the parties, and I think everything we can do to lessen sort of the trial by ambush approach in our process is fundamentally helpful, I think, both to the parties generally and to the court and its administration of justice. We also probably want an amendment, as we talked yesterday, in probably changing the 45-day to the 60 days to tie it again directly to the summary judgment standard or the time frame that was put in the council court procedures changes. So that would be another thing that I would recommend, just so that they're tracking at an equal level. And I think it's appropriate to ought to know 60 days before trial whether or not you think you've got a punitive damage claim in a case. That doesn't seem to me to present a real challenge to parties. Similarly, we can let them work on this issue about the limitation on amendments in mandatory arbitration, which would be worth having somebody take a look at. Representative Shetterly?
Thank you. Just I think that sounds fine, and while this is being amended, I hoped it with our VAR representatives. Now they're all whispering to each other. With our VAR representatives here, that maybe the Practice and Procedure Committee could at least get a look at that. We know, in fact, that they have seen it. I don't do enough of this to have a good sense of
it. Ms. Gravy, do you want to come up and comment, if you've got a comment to make?
Thank you, Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, and members of the committee. I'm Susan Gravy, for the record, with the State Bar Public Affairs Program. The Procedure and Practice Committee would love to look at this bill and provide some feedback by the next meeting. Both their chair and secretary are out of town, out of the country at the moment. But when they get back, which will be next week, we would love to be able to have an opportunity to review it and be present at the next hearing.
Yeah, that would appreciate that. That would be helpful to the committee. And you might make special note to have them look at the issue as it impacts this court ordered mandatory non-binding arbitration and the ability to replead. That's an issue that we're going to want to obviously follow up on. Did you have something, Representative Ackerman?
No.
Okay. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, for the committee's information and for Ms. Grady's information, there was talk of adding a safe harbor provision similar to the language that's in the motion for summary judgment rules, so that the judge would have discretion to allow the motion to amend under certain circumstances, even if the 60 days is run, to catch situations where, for instance, discovery was not completed either inadvertently or intentionally, and some new fact came up. And so that was something else that was going to be added during when the amendment came in on the 60 days.
Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's great. I think that our committee would actually be very interested in the language of that sort.
Why don't you make sure that they touch base and that you facilitate involvement with Mr. Joseph in getting their feedback on the amendments in advance of our next hearing. It would be nice to know before we schedule it that we've worked through most of the details so we can pull it back in again, and if we're going to move, we're going to do it that meeting and not make this a three-meeting bill. Does that sound okay?
That sounds terrific, and Mr. Joseph and I had talked about coordinating on some of that after this, so we will be happy to do so.
Thank you very much. Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2049, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2053. Do you want to go ahead, Council?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2053 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon Collectors Association. It directs the state court administrator to create standard forms for litigants to use in small claims court. Apparently, according to proponents of the bill, various small claims forms are in circulation either through the Stevens Ness forms program. Some of the courts have their own forms, as well as there are statutory forms that are available. And then, of course, litigants just create forms from their own systems or on the fly, and many litigants proceed pro se, which means they don't have any counsel to help them prepare, so that they're preparing forms handwritten. This bill would direct the state court administrator to create standard forms for everybody to use and mandate that those forms be used, so that the small claims court system could be more formally unified in its procedures and practice, and the types of forms being used. It would also clarify often what are the issues that are being litigated in the small claims matter.
Great. And for witnesses, we have Mr. Swank and Mr. Markey, leading with Mr. Markey.
It's not reported.
If you want to have it together,
is that fine with you? Come on up, Brad, and take a seat. We'll
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. Always a pleasure to be on the witness stand with Brad Swank from the Judicial Department. Representing the Oregon Collectors Association for many, many years, I keep hearing of this problem, they are high-volume users of the small claims courts in the state, representing various businesses attempting to collect debts. And there simply has been a large number of various requirements in different small claims jurisdictions, and it's just really become very cumbersome. I approached the Judicial Department about this issue, and I must say that they have been very cooperative in their efforts in terms of trying to move forward in a process to create some uniform forms. I have Sharina Martin in the audience who would be happy to come up here and answer any questions. She appeared in front of a committee of the Judicial Department's in October and made a presentation to for the department to create a requirement for uniform forms, and we suggested some forms at that time. There are some generic forms that have been developed that are accepted by quite a few small claims departments, but then when you're operating in several different jurisdictions, you'll find a jurisdiction that doesn't allow that particular form but requires another one, and then you'll have four or five jurisdictions that accept another different generic form. And Brad worked with us and got us before the committee on uniform trial court rules. They have adopted, and I guess not adopted, but posted on their website a proposal to adopt these forms that we appeared in front of them with in October, and Brad has that information for you today. My understanding of that, I'm going to let Brad talk about that process. My understanding of that process is that that committee meets twice a year, and that so they post this on the website in October and November, and then people have several months to respond. And depending upon the responses, they may or may not adopt this as a final rule. I guess it's just we would like to see something in the statute that requires that there be some standardization of forms. I have read this bill to say that there had to be standard forms which had to be used. I never have read the bill to mean that a court couldn't accept other forms as well as the standard ones that were prescribed. Brad reads the bill that way, and I wouldn't have any problem changing it to allow a jurisdiction to accept other forms as well as the standardized forms. We simply want to move this forward and make sure that some kind of standardization occur in the next couple of years in this system. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Markey? Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions that I'll wrap into one, if I may. One is, do municipal courts ever hear small claims issues? And the second is, I thought I heard you say that it would be okay to use other forms, but if everybody's going to go to a standardized form, then why would they want to have another form? I mean, other than historically. And
Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak for Mr. Swank. Mr. Swank brought this as an issue, and perhaps you should hear his testimony and then allow him to answer that. I believe it has to do with some businesses may not want to use this form. Some court may want to accept an additional form beyond the standardized form. I don't object to that in any way. I just want my clients to be able to use standardized forms so that they can have one form in their office that works in 36 counties instead of having 30 or more different forms that are probably not 30, but 20 or more forms that they would have to keep in stock.
Why don't we go ahead and have Mr. Swank make his comments.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Office of State Court Administrator. And also, in this instance, I happen to be the reporter for the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee. Almost a year ago, Mr. Markey first approached me and said, you know, it would be a good idea if there were standardized forms to do in small claims, because he represents businesses that practice in a lot of different places in the state. And I encouraged him to come before the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee, which is a process we have had in place since 1987 to help make things uniform in courts where they need to be uniform or not uniform. And you know, it's a place to consider that. Now, the Uniform Trial Court Rules are rules that are adopted by the Chief Justice, and they are Chief Justice rules. And when the Chief Justice adopts a Uniform Trial Court Rule, that becomes uniform throughout the state with respect to what it addresses. Courts are also allowed to have their own local practices where necessary. And those are done through supplementary local rules. So we started this process last fall. He came in and made a proposal. The Chief Justice was very interested in the proposal, so we made sure it got on the committee agenda. I understand that the UTCR committee does not adopt rules nor disapprove rules. They make recommendations to the Chief Justice, who then adopts the rules or doesn't adopt the rules. And one of the things I have handed out to you is a copy of what we printed in the advance sheets, the Oregon Appellate Court's advance sheets, which is how we give notice to all the attorneys in the bar. We also now put this information on our website, as is mentioned in the front, so people can comment electronically on our proposals and tell us that what a great idea, or how could you think of anything so stupid? Because frankly, every recommendation that comes in goes on the agenda. There's no pre-screening, as you can tell by what was here. What you have is the fall agenda. There were certain things that were recommended by the committee for approval, certain things that were recommended for disapproval, and people think that there are stupid things on both sides of them. But we meet then in the spring and consider all of the public comment, and the committee makes a final recommendation to the chief based on public comment. And our rules require that we have 45 days, which by the time you do all the timing and everything, is why we only meet two times a year, because it takes so long. One thing you will see in here on page A16 and A17 is a discussion that we put out of how we got to where we were with the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee and of the proposed rule that people can look at. And we've actually found that in terms of proposing forms and making them mandatory statewide, and we did this for probate accounting a couple of years ago and caused quite a controversy because we adopted a form and everybody was afraid we were going to mandate it on a certain date, and we've got all kinds of attorneys and people who have their own forms out there and have them on their word processor, and there's Stevens Ness and other people who have their forms that they sell. And the real interest with the probate thing, as we think with this small claims thing, is there are certain businesses that practice statewide that want to be able to use their particular forms in any county they go to, rather than putting everybody else out of business and making them worry about the inventories of forms, and they have to get them done by a certain day, and what do you do if a pro se does something different. All that. So our practice when we do forms has been to say that these forms will be acceptable in any court, and allow courts to have their own, but they can mandate them. If you see the proposed rule 15.010, it says forms in these formats may be made mandatory by SOR. SOR 15.011 is reserved for making such forms mandatory. So if a court wants to go exclusively to them, we can. We have, in the judicial branch, we have the same struggle between state control and local control that you do here. And there's a strong preference for local courts to be allowed to do things their own way as long as it doesn't interfere with some state mandate. So we do have, particularly with small claims, which has always been a local issue and on which practices vary substantially from court to court. Our concern is that we don't want to mandate that all courts undergo the process of changing everything they do on a specific date because of the fiscal impacts that might have, but we want to move in the direction of allowing these forms to be used for the statutorily mandated things because it's a good business practice. I mean, businesses that practice statewide should be able to rely on certain forms, as should people in pro se should be able to go to our website where this would probably be. So, in short, I mean, our preference would be of a couple of things. One, that I mean, there's nothing like being mandated to do something that's a direction that you're already headed. But secondly, these are Chief Justice rules are the direction that we're heading now because we already have a process set up for reviewing and making recommendations on those and for members of the public to participate and comment on what we're doing. So one thing that you might want to think about is rather than the state court administrator, it would be if the Chief Justice establishes rules creating uniform forms under ORS 1.002, which is what the uniform trial court rules are, that would match the process that we've already followed and which may have forms established by as early as this August. Secondly, we would like the second sentence says small claims, the Small Claims Department of Circuit Court must use the standard forms established by this section. We would like it clear that these forms have to be acceptable, but not that they be the only forms, because it's, as I say, in our experience, a little less heavy-handed to let local courts sort of move into their own thing, use their own forms when it's appropriate, but accept the ones that are acceptable statewide. And thirdly, just an issue, and this is something that Representative Crummell raised, and I don't know where whether you want to go here or not, but I thought it would be an issue that you might want to chew on, and that is justice courts. And there are, I think, 18 or 23 of them in the state now, have to have a small claims department in their justice court currently. And that's something they have to have. Municipal courts, there's a strong argument that municipal courts have authority to create under their statutory provisions for municipal courts something that would deal with small claims in their city. And I've heard city attorneys discuss that both ways. I'm not an expert in local government law, so I couldn't tell you. There's a question about whether or not you would want to make the same forms mandatory for small claims in a municipal court or a justice court if they had it, or you'd want to allow them to adopt if you want to address that issue at all, if you just want to think about it sort of on a state level and go there later if appropriate. But I thought I'd raise it because if the real goal is to allow businesses that practice statewide to use the same form in any small claims court that they go into, then that it's something, at some point, that would have to be something that's addressed legislatively because we can't mandate, we have no authority over justice courts currently except for appellate jurisdiction, so in terms of forms and practices, and that would be the same true of municipal courts. So that's sort of a summary of my testimony. We think it's a good idea to head in the direction of mandatory forms. We have a forum where we work on that, where they would be standard statewide, and we've been working on that with Mr. Marquis. And we would like to see some minor changes in the bill that we think it would be. We think it's a direction we're heading anyway because of the business practice and the fact that it's just good business to do it that way, and we're trying to be conscious of that. So that's my testimony, and I can ask there any questions you might have.
Thank you, Representative Chevrolet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Brad, if the bill is amended to accommodate the process that you're already heading down, does that take care of the fiscal impact?
Well, if you make it, the process is one thing. I mean, there are courts that have other forms. We didn't have the money, frankly, to do an inventory of all of the forms that are out there for all of the different small claims departments in the state. And to date, they have all been exclusively under the control of the local court because nobody's ever raised the issue before. So when they raise the issue, We looked at the statutory forms to find out which ones were mandated by statute, and those are the ones that started. I don't know if there are other forms that they're requiring for their process now, and we still don't have, frankly, the money to do a statewide inventory of all of those forms and check them and compare them and do those sorts of things. So we would like for them to be able to continue to use whatever their process is, but for the statutorily mandated things, we'll do the forms, and to the extent that we can move into the other forms, if there are others, or affect their process, we'd like to do that through the UTCR process because of the public input that allows, and because it's all already advertised and people know where it is. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah. We have a new witness at the dais.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Serena Martin, who is the manager of Cascade Collections, and she's a person who actually deals with this on a daily basis, and I thought perhaps committee members might have a question for her.
Ms. Martin, do you have anything to testify to, or do you just want to respond to questions?
I'm here to respond if necessary.
Okay, all right. Thank you. I have questions, Representative Anderson, and then Representative Prozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any date certain in mind, year, 2 years out, where you'll be using up supplies and where you could go to these forms? Or
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, we don't. The UTCR that you've seen passed out in front of you, there's a good likelihood that there will be a UTCR of that form that has been adopted and that takes effect on August 1st of this year. That's the target. Now, that UTCR would not, what it would say is that these forms can be used in any court. So if somebody wanted to use them for their particular small claims, they could. But if they also wanted to go down to Stevens Ness and buy Stevens Ness forms, and if that court accepted those, they could do that too. It would be their choice as opposed to the court's choice. So as of August 1st, there would be something in place that would protect the businesses that he's dealing with. In terms of when people would run out and when they would, you know, go to something that's absolutely uniform statewide, my personal experience is that we will probably never have everything absolutely uniform statewide in all the courts of this state, but there will always be some local control and some local quirk because it serves the purpose and because the nature of the courts varies so much. In some places, we've got one clerk who does all the small claims, and she gets used to things a certain way, and in some places like Multnomah County, we've got maybe 5 or 10 people or more who deal with small claims on a regular basis. The size of the court can make a big difference in how they process these and what procedures they want locally.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Just to clarify, please, I want to emphasize. I, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, have absolutely no problem with any kind of an amendment that clearly states that that these courts can accept other forms in addition to the standard form. But I do want a standard form that has to be accepted by all of them. And Mr. Swank and I have worked well together in the past and will continue to work together in the future. But my problem is, if this process of public input takes on a life of its own, and we get a lot of small claims courts saying we just think it's a terrible idea to have standard forms, and this committee meets again in April or May or whenever they meet, and they say, well, this was just a bad idea, but thanks for your input. That's not where I want to wind up. And so I really feel strongly that there needs to be a mandate in the statute that we move to some kind of standardized forms. This is not rocket science. These are one-page forms. So I think that's the only area of disagreements. And as to the inclusion of justice or municipal courts, I haven't had discussions with the counties. I haven't had discussion with justice courts. Our guys would love to have uniform forms in justice courts. We viewed that as a little different problem than a state court system, we would be happy. It may be that the counties and the justice courts would say fine. If they did, I would not object at all to that kind of an amendment. I think the municipal courts might be a little more difficult. I think there's a serious question as to whether they actually have small claims authority. And I'm just not sure that that's a can of worms I want to get in the middle of.
Yeah, didn't you and the Chief Justice have that conversation?
We determined, that municipal courts did not have small claims jurisdiction.
Right.
I think that would be the position most people would take.
We don't. Municipal courts, the ones I serve in, do not have any type of civil small claims.
Right. I'd be happy to meet with the counties and see if that was something that they wanted to look at for this, if that's the desire of the committee. I'm happy to do whatever you would like.
Mr. Swain, to the extent that the bill would not preclude the court's acceptance of other forms, but mandate the preparation of a unified form which everyone would have to accept, where's the downside to that approach? So the people who currently have their Stevens Nest forms that they're currently using or a form that they're currently using could still be potentially accepted by the court if the court chose to do that, but there would be a standard form that everybody knew that if they used that standard form for a small claims action, it would be appropriate and accepted in all jurisdictions.
Chair Williams, it is the track we're on. It's something that we did and that the Chief Justice was interested in doing and that we did in response to a problem that was brought to us, and we had a problem to address and a process to address. And I guess part of the thinking is if we have a process to address this and we're addressing it and we're moving in that direction, we're concurrent, it doesn't cost anything to do that, we're not sure we always want to find ourselves in front of the legislature talking about things that we're already trying to solve under processes that we already have and that we have a strong interest in solving. And I understand that there are political issues behind this, but, a business came to us. It said we have a problem. We said let us help you try to solve that problem because we have a process to deal with that. And we're halfway down the road on that already, on doing that, and here we are. So it's I guess as much a perception about trust as it is about other things. But that's your purview. I mean, we've gone down the road and we've done what we thought we would be expected to do in these circumstances. And work, as Jim said, we have worked well on many things in the past, and we thought this was one of them.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'm not here to impugn anybody's integrity. The court system has really moved forward on this. I just want to make sure it happens, and I think there's a significant possibility that not because of the Judicial Department, and not because of the Chief Justice, but I think they will get a lot of political pressure over the next few months from these small claims departments that don't want to be uniform. They want to do it their way. And I think this, if anything, this helps the Judicial Department because it's an easy response for them.
Representative Brzezinski.
Ms. Marquis, I guess I'm going to take a little issue because I'm not sure, unless you've had the experience with the small claims departments, in discussing this, I've looked at this form that came from whoever from Marion County, very similar to the one that Lane County uses. There is little differences, but pretty much has the same format. And I would hope that they would welcome having some type of uniformity. The one question I would want to pose about the JP courts, since they are county courts, it would seem that we need to move slowly on this because are we going to be mandating something to the county level that I'm not sure if that's where we need to be or where we want to go and the cost that may be required.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, that was our concern as well.
Representative Shetterly.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'm not privy to all the politics of the Judicial Department, I guess, but I'm not sure, Jim, that I understand the political pushback from small claims departments. I mean, they're not economists. They're part of the circuit court, and they're under the local presiding judge who's under the Supreme Court the Chief Justice. I don't understand the issue of resistance here. It seems to me if the judge if the Supreme Court Chief Justice tells the State Court Administrator's office we're going down this direction, then they're going down that direction, and they get feedback from
Mr. Chairman, Representative Chatterley, this is published specifically for comment. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that you're going to get a bunch of comments that say, well, that may work for Marion County, but that's not the way we do it here. And we want to do something different. So, and then the final decision is going to be made on that comment. And I guess Sharina could tell you that there are several uniform kind of generic forms. And these people just say, well, not in our county. So I know there's resistance.
Further comment and discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Could we, again, have the time frame for the rules being commented on when we expect to actually have some committee? Was it March or April?
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, if you will see... and it's one of the reasons that I handed these out to you. There's a public meeting in March 21st at the State Court Administrator's office, and you're all welcome to come. And we notice these, and one of the interesting things that we have, a lot of the public doesn't show up for this kind of really sort of thing, but it's March 21st is when they will meet, and that's the date we will know what the committee's recommendation is. And where the chief will know that's that same day or the Monday thereafter, because I think that's a Saturday, and the chief gets to make a decision. And the chief has not always sided with recommendations of the committee, and this is one thing that I think he has expressed to me. I mean, it makes sense, which is why when Jim came to me, he originally came to me and said, "What would you think about a bill?" And I said, "Well, you know, we have a process. What would you think about using the process that's in place that could get it done arguably sooner than?" And he did come, and he used the process. And I think his people were well received at the meeting because people go, as you're all thinking right now, and I can see it in your face, you go, this makes so much sense. And it does make sense. So it's March 21st. That's a long answer to yours when the meeting is.
Representative Barker.
I just want to say it makes sense to me, being a non-lawyer, that why should some justice of the peace upset everybody when we're trying to become have the state working business friendly? It makes what they're saying is we want one form can be used anywhere, and if the local guy says that you can use other forms, that's fine. It would make it easier, I can see, for the businesses to be able to have one form they could file either in, it doesn't matter if it's in Burns or in Portland.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker. This sort of evolved historically because it used to be that courts really had a local constituency and that most of the business they did was local. And so they would tailor design things to their local businesses because it gave them an advantage in it, all of those sorts of things. And both with law firms and with collection agencies, you're starting to see the emergence of businesses and attorneys that are going out and doing things statewide. And it's why we formed the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee 17 years ago, and why because there are some practices that it makes sense to do local because of the size of the court, and there are some practices that, you know, they should be uniform because we've got people doing things uniform on a uniform basis, and that's why we have that forum and why anything anybody proposes. And you notice one of the things proposed in here was an amendment to require that all pleadings must be presented in black ink only. The committee didn't go with that, but that was something that somebody believed should be made uniform statewide. And it's because of the evolution of the legal business and the collecting business and how business is done here.
Further questions? Here's what I'd like to do. Since the issue of the justice courts has been raised, it wouldn't help or hurt, Jim, to do a little due diligence, I think, with the justice courts and figure out if we were to proceed, if there was a way to bring them in on the concept of a unified form. I think that makes some sense. In the meantime, the process is still going forward. As much as I would like to think that we wouldn't be here in March, we probably will be.
You mean March of 2004?
Yeah, well,
March?
Unless some serious disaster strikes us. And let's continue to talk about this, and I'd like to actually talk to both of you at some point about this issue as well. So why don't we go ahead at this time and close the public hearing
on
House Bill 2053, and thank you both for your testimony. We're now going to move on to
287.
Public hearing on House Bill 2057. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2087 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar and the Council on Court Procedures. This bill modifies the procedures for promulgation, amendment, or appeal of a rule of civil procedure. It adds a provision that states that the council must publish or distribute notification of the changes made to any proposed language within 60 days after the meeting at which the changes are made. It's my understanding currently that there's, to the members of the bar, there's 30 days advance notice of the meeting. But once a rule is changed, there's no provision for subsequent notice. And oftentimes there are comments that come in on corrections or other things that would like to be changed with the rule, and there's no process to deal with that, and this would be adding that process.
Great. Thank you, Council. Our witness is Judge Rasmussen from Lane County, and we welcome you back, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Carson Rasmussen, Lane County Circuit Court Judge, and also member of the Council on Court Procedure, which I've served on for 8 years. I would like to begin by noting that I'm testifying on my own behalf today, not on behalf of the judicial branch of government, as I prefer to call it, for reasons that we discussed last week or the week before.
You mind if we ask you some questions about small claims form?
Boy, I was sitting in the back of the room thinking maybe I ought to duck out right now. Let me read first my prepared testimony. As many of you, I'm sure, know, the Council on Court Procedures was created in 1977 to draft rules governing Oregon pleading and practice, and those rules are contained now both in statute and, of course, in the ORCP, which most practitioners have in a separate volume. The Council reviews Oregon laws relating to civil procedure and studies relevant proposals advanced by other parties. The Council then proposes new rules or amendments to the existing rules, and it has no jurisdiction over the rules of evidence or the rules of appellate procedure. The Oregon State Bar Practice and Procedure Committee, at the request of the Council, has asked that House Bill 2087 be considered by the legislature. The Council submits a report with rule changes adopted by the Council to the legislature at the beginning of every session. The legislature may then amend, repeal, or modify suggested rule changes made by the Council. Those changes go into effect on January 1 following this legislative cycle, unless changes are made by the legislative branch of government. Those changes are then published by Legislative Council's office in the Oregon Revised Statutes. The problem that the Council on Court Procedure is trying to address with this bill relates to the Council's publication and notice requirements contained in ORS 1.735. The Council is currently required to publish proposed rule changes to the Oregon State Bar membership and allow for a notice and comment period, after which the Council meets to finalize its report to the legislature. Unfortunately, currently, the Council is unable to make changes to its final set of recommendations in light of those that feedback that we received from the Bar. This bill would require that the Council publish or distribute notification of changes made to proposed language within 60 days after the meeting at which the changes are made. This would allow the Council to make changes to its final recommendations at the meeting in which final action is taken, and would allow us to make those changes in light of the public testimony. The opportunity for bar membership to review proposed rule changes in a notice and comment period is only valuable to the Council if it is able to respond to that feedback received during the notice and comment period to make any necessary changes to its proposed final set of recommendations. in addition by adding a requirement that the council must publish or distribute notification to the membership of any changes to the proposed final set of recommendations within 60 days after the meeting at which the final action is taken. The membership is kept fully informed. Let me see if I can reduce this to a couple of words. First of all, this is, for the most part, something of a house-cleaning measure. There are 23 members on the council. 22 members have voted in favor of requesting this change. The change really deals with line 18 of the bill, in which final action is taken. That language is removed from the legislation, thus meaning the following. As it is now, the council promulgates a proposed set of amendments. It then takes public comment. Because of the language of the statute, the council cannot change the language in any proposed amendment after it receives the public comment. Now, that's not to say there is no public comment process, because the reality is the council acts in an extended session over many, many months and receives public comment throughout. But if someone were to write in response to proposed changes that when you put a certain comment a certain place, it has a totally different meaning than you intended, and the council wakes up and says, you know, that's right, the council cannot make that change because of the exact language requirement. This essentially eliminates that impediment to taking account of any public testimony, but still requires a notice requirement so that members of the bar are aware of what the council has done, and then assumingly can come to you and say, well, now the council has done something different than they should have done, and we would like the legislature to look at it. I'd be very happy to answer any questions. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I do note that the bill apparently contains a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, although I'm told it does, and that perhaps surprises you, Mr. Chairman, but you looked at me in that manner. But I don't, at least at first blush, see any financial implication to the bill whatsoever.
Yeah, I agree with you, Judge, that I don't believe that this bill, for any reason, should be referred down to Ways and Means after the committee takes action on it. It's on a list of a handful of bills that have got a subsequent referral added to them that I think were done the interest of caution, but I think that we're going to try to have those subsequent referrals removed.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Sherrilling.
Well, I see on the staff measure summary says may have fiscal impact, but no statement yet issued. It may be worth scheduling this for a work session and getting a fiscal impact statement up here.
Representative Sherrilling, I think the way that shows up on the staff measure summary is that's an automatic listing that occurs once a measure has a subsequent referral attached to it. So once the Speaker's office is attached to a subsequent referral, it automatically results in a may have fiscal impact response. We could certainly request fiscal provide a statement to us in advance of the next work session. The frustrating part about that is I know they're busy with the stuff that really does have a fiscal impact, and it's troubling to get them to spend a lot of time, I think, you know, preparing a special report on an issue that I think we clearly can see doesn't have a fiscal impact. If I can
Mr.
add.
Chair?
Yeah, Representative Przanski and then Council.
I wonder if we couldn't use the scenario that Representative Shutterly had suggested before, of the just passing the floor with the subsequent referral, and then maybe the Chair and or Council can find out whether it can be released before it would be passed out of the House. And that way it could maybe go on its way to the Senate.
There is a script for the rescinding of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We haven't done that yet. We probably will have to do it on on at least several bills. My preference is to not do that until we've, you know, cleared that with the Speaker's office, to not catch them unawares. You're suggesting that we refer it down now with the subsequent referral?
My understanding is we've done the rescinding, but we've always gotten the approval of the Speaker's office. But
right.
I thought on last week we had some bills that Representative Shutterly moved for a de-pass to the floor with the subsequent referral, and then we were thinking that it would maybe be cleared up before it got there. Mm-hmm.
No,
that one was going.
Yeah, that one was going to Ways and Means. And
my apologies.
And the proper language of that motion is to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means is how that motion is worded. So if we don't want it to go, I'm nervous to refer it out for fear of having to take it back. My preference would be to try to get the rescission language and have the subsequent referral rescinded. It just seems like it's troubling to send it down to Ways and Means when there's no good reason. They're going to have plenty to work on down there without stuff that shouldn't necessarily be there. At the same time, I'm you know, it would be nice to get the bill on its way, but I think you would prefer, Judge, that we not send it down to the great black hole of the legislature if there's an opportunity to not do that, I would suspect.
Mr. Chairman, I used to count votes, and I would prefer that it go down one time and not more than once. So.
Okay. Are there any other questions for His Honor about the bill?
I want to add.
Oh, yes, counsel.
I have a note here on my agenda that says no fiscal or revenue impact, but I only have the revenue statement in my file, and it's highly possible the fiscal might have come back while I was out, although usually with a subsequent referral, I would probably not get that fiscal report. But I do see that here. I don't know where that came from.
Well, we've got one more bill. Maybe when we're doing the next bill, you might go check your office and see if the fiscal statement has come back. If you do have it and it says that there isn't one, we may also ask Patsy to bring in or to print out a copy, if you're listening, Patsy, of the motion language for the rescission of the Ways and Means referral. And maybe we can still handle this before the end of our meeting time. So okay. Why don't we do that? If there are no further questions for the judge, then we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2087. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2270. And 2270, our witness is Bernie Vail. And, Professor, are you here today on behalf of the State Bar or the Law Commission or both?
I'm here on behalf of the State Bar.
Oh, good. Good to see you.
Chair Williams, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Bernie Vail. I'm a professor at Lewis and Clark College's Northwestern School of Law, and I'm currently chair of the State Bar's Estate Planning and Administration section. The section is composed of attorneys throughout the state who practice involved drafting wills, trusts, and other estate planning documents and administering decedents' estates. And the executive committee has proposed House Bill 2270. It's basically a bill to consolidate the law of wills and will substitutes, if you will. Oregon law currently provides that gifts under a will to a spouse are automatically revoked by divorce. The factual situation that gives rise to that rule is the not unusual circumstance of a divorce occurring and someone failing to subsequently amend their will and then dying with a will still in effect that leaves property to the spouse. The Oregon statute as it now exists revokes gifts in a will to a former spouse. There is no corollary in the law of will substitutes, and this bill is intended to provide that beneficiary designations in will substitutes such as life insurance policies and retirement plans would be treated similarly. The presumption that underlies the wills rule is the, I guess, intuitive proposition that most people don't want to benefit their former spouse financially. And it seems rather strange to say that although I don't want my former spouse to benefit under my will, I'd love to have her have my insurance policy. This bill simply consolidates the law of wills and, as I call it, will substitutes, other means of transmitting wealth. It basically provides that beneficiary designations in favor of a spouse or relative of a spouse in certain types of retirement plans and life insurance policies are automatically revoked on divorce to take into account, again, the possibility that someone gets a divorce and neglects to change their life insurance policy, which still names the former spouse as a primary beneficiary. The committee does not expect any adverse consequences or financial impact from the passage of this bill. It's, as a matter of fact, one of a number of bills sponsored by the estate planning section that will be coming before this committee in the course of its deliberations, all of which are aimed at unifying the law of wills and will substitutes. We have another bill that deals with applying some wills rules to trusts, inter vivos trusts. So I'll be back before you again probably on those bills. Are there any questions from the committee?
Yes, Representative Shirley, and then Representative McPherson.
Thank you. Bernie, two questions, and I'll put them to you and then let you respond. In Section 2, the definition of governing instrument, I know in my practice I see a lot in the way of what brokerage firms now have gone to transfer on death or pay on death accounts. Have you thought about adding those? I mean, the policy seems to be the same, and also I know certificates of deposit, for instance, at banks will have a pay-on-death feature. So if we're expanding the policy, should we expand it to all of those various instruments that may pass on death? And then the other question I had, that's the one, and then Section 4 says that if you have a divorce, the effect is as if the former spouse or relative has disclaimed all payments. And I see that as being different than, as I understand under the law, wills right now, the effect is as if they predeceased, in which case, if you have, in this case, as I understand, disclaimer means that if the beneficiary disclaims, then the benefits accrue to the down the bloodline, basically, of the beneficiary, whereas if they predecease, it would go, in this case, to the contingent beneficiary. That is, if they're treated as having predeceased, it would pay to the contingent beneficiary named on the policy. And wouldn't that be preferable? For instance, if that deceased spouse, you know, has remarried and has children of the other marriage, to treat that as a disclaimer would pass those benefits down to that spouse's children of that other marriage. And wouldn't we want to maybe treat it as if the former spouse has predeceased the decedent, so then it would pass either to the named contingent beneficiaries or by default to the estate of the deceased and then go according to whatever their...
If I may respond to that, Representative Chetterly, the problem, I think, is that the possibility of the application of an anti-lapse statute in the wills area leads to the possibility that if someone predeceases someone else, an anti-lapse statute might apply to pass the property to lineal descendants of the predeceased person, whereas no such possibility exists under a disclaimer. There is no application of an anti-lapse statute in a disclaimer situation.
What's the, if I may,
please,
the effect of a disclaimer? Who gets the property if I leave property to you and you disclaim? Who gets the property then? You can't direct the disclaimer.
No, I can't. Exactly. I have no.
It passes down your bloodline?
No, it does not. It passes under the terms of the trust instrument, or the instrument that created the interest. I have no control over how it passes if I disclaim.
Okay, you're my law professor. Well, I
funny, it was mine on the same subject.
No, I had it for mortgage, for property transactions.
Oh, okay.
But, Mr. Chair, if I may, on the first one about the other instruments, the POD accounts.
It raises an interesting point. This is an area that the members of the committee had some disagreement on. The Uniform Probate Code, which is a model for wills law in many states, has gone to exactly the area that you suggest, making governing instrument definitionally control any will substitute. The Uniform Probate Code has a definition of governing instrument that's extremely broad. It covers wills, trust, deeds, life insurance policies, anything, TOD accounts, POD accounts. And the Uniform Probate Code position is that all of them should be treated the same. There was some disagreement in the drafting committee that came up with House Bill 2270. Some people were in favor of broadening it, as did the Uniform Probate Code. Others were in favor of limiting it to certain types of will substitutes. From a policy standpoint, I frankly hold no brief for limiting it to certain types. I rather think that the uniform treatment across the board makes more sense. But this was a committee drafted bill, and of course, what comes out of a committee depends upon consensus. None of you ever heard that, of course. But no.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Vail, this bill engages a problem that I've actually encountered a number of occasions in my practice working with retirement plans, and I wanted to explore whether what consideration had been given to federal preemption issues, that is, where a plan is subject to ERISA, which it broadly preempts state law, but not absolutely. And I'm wondering whether this kind of clause, which I'm actually accustomed to drafting into the plan documents for retirement plans that I work on, whether as a matter of state law, we have the authority to establish this rule as it would apply to those regulated plans?
Representative McPherson, Chair Williams, frankly, the answer is no, we don't, because of the Egelhoff case. U.S. Supreme Court decided in the context of a Washington statute of a similar nature that Washington had no power to affect an ERISA plan because of the federal preemption issue. And I think we're faced with that decision. Unless there is some congressional change, which may not be unheard of, unless there is a congressional change in the ERISA statute, it is true that we have no control over revocation of an ERISA designation. But I don't know what the fix to that is, other than a change in the federal law or an overturning of the Egelhoff case. It seems that those are immune from state law revocation issues.
Mr. Chair, can I
yes.
follow up?
Please.
To sort of describe a strategy, perhaps, then, since federal preemption in the ERISA area is a fluid concept. I'm gathering that the including the references to federally regulated plans and benefits perhaps is being done in anticipation that the law in that area may settle out in a way that would allow these to be effective.
That's true. The alternative was to exclude ERISA plans from the operation of this statute, and of course if we did that and then ERISA changed, allowing state control of the revocation issue, then we would have somehow excluded the ERISA plans, so we decided to include them, even faced with the federal preemption issue, in the hopes that federal law will eventually. I think, frankly, as more states are adopting this type of statute and more are, the application of Will's rules to will substitutes is a growing trend in the United States. And as I think as more and more states adopt this kind of statute, I think Congress is eventually going to allow that the state will have control at least of that issue.
Right, and I think the anticipating that happy circumstance is probably a good idea.
Representative Ackerman, then Representative Barker, then Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have about three questions. My first one is I don't see any definition of what the contents of the notice should contain. The way I read this, the insurance company could get a notice of the divorce. That, as a matter of law, would require a change of beneficiary, but yet the notice doesn't compel them to do it, doesn't inform them to do that. Am I reading this correctly?
The statute does not, as drafted, does not provide for any specific form of notice. No, I think the question of what is adequate written notice does not, in my view, need to be specifically defined because of the difficulty of following a standardized form. If the insurance company is aware through a written notice that an insured has been divorced, I think that fact is what the bill is looking at.
I think it'd be clearer to the insurance company if the notice was, if we did designate in the notice what the legal effect was, because, and dealing with insurance companies, I know that you may have hundreds of claims persons, and they're going to be out of state. They're going to get something like this in the mail, and it doesn't say what the legal import of it is, and that's what bothers me. So I think for clarity purposes, I would see if we could maybe, by amendment, determine what the notice should state so the insurance company's on notice. Same thing happens when the divorce or the parties remarry. Another notice goes out, but again, it doesn't say that the effect of it is to restore the former spouse to her former position as a beneficiary. I'm just talking about notice to the insurance company, so I just want to raise those points for discussion, and maybe we could have some clarifying amendments. My second, I guess, question or subject area is under Section 6, Sub 3, where I think accurately you state the process, which would be in the event of a dispute, to pay the funds into the court. But wouldn't it be more clear to identify the process as interpleader proceedings so that we know that there's a definite process set up?
In effect, that's what the bill refers to. It is an interpleader, in essence, if there has been no probate estate already opened. If there has been a probate estate already opened, it's simply made part of the probate process.
Okay.
But if there is no estate opened, it is, in effect, an interpleader action, yes.
All right. My last is, did the committee consider the intent of the insured? I can surely see that on divorce, that it would be the intent to, revoke beneficiary status of the former spouse. But upon remarriage, to revive that beneficiary status seems to me a stretch of legislative intent to in relationship to the intent of the insurer. Did the committee discuss those levels of intent?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, what the committee in essence did is paralleled the will statute in this respect, because the will statute providing for revocation of a will by divorce has a provision in it that provides on remarriage the revocation ceases to exist. And we were simply trying to give parallel treatment to wills and will substitutes.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. Representative Barker, then
Professor Bale, one of the things, if I'm hearing this right, we're saying, if, for example, if I get divorced and I'm remarried to somebody and then I die, that life insurance, I forget to change it, still my first wife's name, it goes to the second wife?
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, not automatically. No, it would actually become, an asset of your probate estate, which would probably wind up going to your second spouse eventually anyway, but it doesn't simply change the designation in the policy from one name to the other.
I'm just concerned because some people may, in fact, leave a life insurance policy without declaring it to their first wife. I had a friend of mine got killed in an on-the-job accident. I take the widow to select the coffin. While we're selecting that, she says, oh, yeah, I got to talk to you about the $34,000 union insurance policy I have, and I had to tell her it's still in Louise's name, it's not in your name. And so the insurance carrier said, well, I'm sure Louise will give this new widow with the children the money. Louise said, oh no, he wanted me to have that because I was 12 years in that marriage and walked away with nothing, and he has the house and he has the airplane, he wanted me to have that money. I mean, I think we're being presumptive to pick that out, to step in and decide where that money's going. It's up to him to change that, not up to us.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, I think the thrust of the will's presumptions that we're starting from is a presumption that is based upon what most people probably want.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably true in this area that most people probably would not want their former spouse to benefit after a divorce, either through their will or through their insurance policy. Now, it's true that some people might, but the bill, of course, includes the possibility that if you look at Section 3 of the bill, except as provided by the express terms of the governing instrument or a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement or judgment, so that if there is someone who does desire their former spouse to benefit by the policy, the onus is on them to make that known through a written instrument, whereas the majority of cases that we're going to be dealing with are cases where no one has done anything. So it's a question of how many people are going to benefit which way.
If I may, it's the responsibility of the insured, I think, to change that. I mean, I understand you're trying to make this the same as the will, but I just, the red flags just fly up to me on that one, and we, again, after this incident, spent some money notifying all of our members, take a look at your insurance policy and where is it, because this was, you know, in police, and occasionally in police departments there are divorces, so we had quite a few people that had maybe moved two or three on down the line.
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, you're correct. Even in the wills area, if I have a will giving my property to my former spouse and I die, it's my responsibility to change my will. The problem is, what if I don't? What if I don't? And the wills rule has been developed by the courts over the course of several hundred years. There are a number of presumptions of intent that are applied, and this one is one that seems to be in keeping with what most people probably would prefer.
And your statement, Professor Vail, that it is a presumption, is indicated that it can be rebutted.
Oh, yeah.
With sufficient evidence.
It started out as a judicially created right. presumption of intent. It has now been enacted right. statutorily right. and is no longer a presumption. It's a rule.
Right.
It's a statutorily enacted rule now.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no problem with the policy. I think the policy is a good one. I'd like a little bit more time to look at this, perhaps. You know, I was comparing the language of the revocation by divorce statute, and that says the effect is the same as though the former spouse did not survive the testator. And then comparing that to the language in the disclaimer statute, it says where this is 105.633, basically it says if the disclaimant is an individual, the disclaimed interest passes as if the disclaimant had died immediately before the time of distribution, which is different than immediately before the death of the decedent. And that's where I think this gets balled up, at least as I read this, or some clarification, where it gets balled up in the estate of the former spouse as opposed to going to the contingent beneficiaries named on the governing instrument. Because this says it's distributed as if the, in this case, former spouse, the disclaimant, had died immediately before the time of distribution, which tells me it's vested. It's gone to that person, but it doesn't stick. It just passes through according to that person's estate.
Point.
Distribution, yeah. And it doesn't go then to the contingent beneficiaries on the instrument itself. At least worth talking about.
Perhaps we might need a clarification.
Yeah. I like the policy. I think just
anything else, Representative McPherson?
No, I'd like to pursue the same point that Representative Shetterly was identifying, as I'd like to understand that distinction more fully,
right.
because the clause that I use in plan documents does use the predeceased language rather than disclaimer language.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? This has been enlightening,
yeah.
especially for those who
get CLE credit.
Representative, well, those of us who don't practice in this area ought to get CLE credit. Representative Crummel.
Yes, those of us that don't practice in this area ought to get CLE credit. I have a question about Section 6, and particularly the first, the subsection 1. So the person is not liable for having made a payment to a beneficiary designated in a governing instrument or for having taken any other action in good faith reliance unless the person has received written notice of a divorce, remarriage, or annulment, so on and so forth. Is that kind of a bailout for a, say, an insurance company has gone ahead and made a payment of a claim on a death to a former spouse, that then all of a sudden they're not liable for having made that payment if it was made in error?
Yes, it is, and it's Chair Williams, Representative Crummel, it's a fairly standard liability exoneration provision that applies in a lot of areas. For example, the banking laws contain a similar exoneration provision for a bank who pays someone at the death of a depositor in accordance with the instrument that governs the account, and it turns out later that someone else is entitled to it. The bank's exonerated from liability, and the reason for these kinds of exoneration provisions is because of the desire not to place the financial institution in the position of being afraid to pay without litigation as to who is entitled to the funds on deposit. It seems to be too onerous to force the financial institution to litigate the issue of who's entitled to the deposit or else refuse to pay anyone.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, so what happens if you have spouse A was married to Mr. X for
10 years, and spouse B then came along and was married to Mr. X for 12 years, and Mr. X passes away. But Mr. X didn't remove and didn't tell the insurance company that he had divorced spouse A. And so now, and so spouse A gets a check. How does spouse B get the money if it's really supposed to go to her?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, the point is that the dispute is properly between the two spouses. It's not between the insurance company and the spouse.
Okay.
What I enjoyed most about that is that the question he posed was very reminiscent of one that I had in your final exam.
And I didn't even take a class from
Professor. No, I did, but there was a certain amount of pleasure in all that.
How did he do?
I can't remember. Yeah, I take the fifth.
And I'm glad you can't remember. I appreciate that. That's smart, Professor Vail. Well, I also have an email that we received from John Powell, who represents AT&T, but also has a bunch of involvement in insurance-related issues. And he had raised the Egelhoff ERISA issue, commented on a similar Washington state law that was enacted that he's aware of that fell, and I think that was the Egelhoff case.
Yes, it was.
And then he talks about whether or not in the definition of insurance, whether this was intended to apply to not only individual policies but group life policies, on the definition of governing instrument. And the issue that he was raising also seems to raise this issue. If you name your spouse or your former spouse after the divorce as the beneficiary, then the presumption isn't there. In other words, if I name my ex-wife after the divorce, but I still go ahead and after the divorce name her as the beneficiary of the policy, then does that operate that wouldn't be impacted? Is that the issue?
Representative Williams, I believe that's correct, right? Because I think a fair reading of the language of the statute indicates that the divorce revokes a pre-existing beneficiary designation.
Right.
And that if no such pre-existing designation was in existence, there wouldn't be any effect.
What I'd like to do is probably have counsel get you a copy of Mr. Powell's email so you can read for yourself the issues which he raised as well. And then I'd encourage you to, and Susan is noting this as I say this, to have the bar section discuss with both Representative Shetterly and Representative McPherson their questions about the bill. To the extent that we want to move the policy issue forward, we'll have the bill back. And you might also spend some time with Representative Parker with respect to some of the concerns he raised. So, thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Professor Vail was the only one who had signed up. So, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2270, and thank you for the interesting discussion. Yeah. We're going to go back now, colleagues, to a work session on House Bill 2087 and open that work session. In the intervening time, we were able to confirm that there was no fiscal impact. We have a fiscal impact statement which demonstrates that, and I communicated with the Speaker's office that they have no objection to our rescission of the Ways and Means subsequent referral. So, the chair would move that we request rescission of the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee on House Bill 2087. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, we will rescind the Ways and Means referral. And now the chair would move that House Bill 2087 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, House Bill 2087 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Barr.
Oh, yes. Representative Barker, we just voted on House Bill 2087 to move to the floor, having rescinded the subsequent referral. Chair would request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended in order to allow Representative Barker to vote on House Bill 2087. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Barker, how do you vote on House Bill 2087?
Yes.
He votes yes. Okay. So House Bill 2087 goes to the floor. Any volunteers to carry the Council on Court Procedures bill? You want to take it, Representative Prozanski? Okay. Representative Prozanski has been assigned the bill. With that, our business is completed. Thank you, committee.
Is this just an information sheet that we want?